Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today. We want a dynamite with no post-rest in sight. AW, lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly. As we hear from John and Waitay. Where we're going, we don't need roads. And if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show. And if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
Hello, everybody. It's John Pollock and Waiting. It's Wednesday night. That means it is time for Rewind a Dynamite, coming off the season premiere of Dynamite. Whole off season countdown until tonight.
What did you do in the off season, John? Two days.
I got a nap in, and I went for a jog. That's what I did during the off season, and here we are back. A whole new season. So, I mean, let's buckle up. This is going to be a huge season ahead.
I'm ready. It's first day of school. I'm excited.
It's kind of like the second day of school for you, is it not? Or third, I should say, by now.
It's the third day of school. Yeah.
How are things going at this point?
For those unaware, my son has started daycare this week. And, I guess they do these things called transitional weeks, where they might give, the child maybe 2 hours, and then they gradually extend it to like 3.5, then to 5. And by the end of a week, they expect you to, accustom the child to like a full day. I think he's ready to take a full day right now. Like, wow. The man has the kid has not like really cried from missing us, at least, he might have cried from, like, I don't know, not being able to nap properly, but like, we drop him off, we say goodbye, and he just like doesn't even like acknowledge us. Like, we'll come back, and we walk in and we're there to pick him up, and like, we're expecting, like, we're hearing all these other kids crying. Okay, like, they're just like, they're missing their parents.
God bless the people that oversee like daycare, like teachers for like kindergartens and stuff. I could not do it.
Unbelievable.
I could not do it.
Unbelievable. You walk into that room and just like the stress levels are just unreal. And how hard it is to even change one kid to like put on a jacket to go outside. They have to do this for like 5 to a person, if not more. Anyway, yeah, all the respect in the world to people who have jobs like that. Anyway, so we're walking in, we're here to pick them up, and like, all these kids are crying. They're like, hugging like the parents, and Oscar's just like, oh, hey. Like, he's like, oh, you, hey, there's a car,
oh my God,
it's been a relatively easy transition.
This is your kid. It is, something else. That's, that's great to hear that it's going so well and you don't have some difficult transition, but
hopefully not. I mean, it's early. Yeah, hopefully not.
So we wanted to start the show off on an unfortunate note, more so from kind of our personal lives, and that is a very well-respected producer in Canadian sports media passed away today by the name of Glenn McDonald. And he was someone that not just a person that Wei and I worked with, but I would say we were very close with. This is somebody that I just selfishly, he meant a lot in my own career. I was just, I was devastated when I got that text this morning. I was unaware that he had been sick, and it's just a really tragic story. He was only 53 years of age. He had a daughter. I mean, it's all I thought about today.
Same. Yeah. I was, shocked to hear it from a former colleague, and I too didn't know what he was, dealing with. And, I remember Glenn's like sort of first interaction with the Fight Network. I mean, he kind of came in as like sort of a one-time job producing. I think it was either before or after the Bell specials at the
Montreal.
Yeah. For one of the St. Pierre fights. And that was even, you know, when he was just kind of like freelancing and not necessarily working for us full time, but like we all loved working with him so much. Such a pro. And I don't know, you meet a lot of people. We've met a lot of people like through those doors during our 10 plus 15 years, you know, working at that place. And he was definitely like one of the best people that I've met in this industry. When John and I were let go, he immediately pulled me over, you know, after he knew what was up. And he just told me exactly what to do, what my next steps would be, and how to protect myself. And just like always just kind of really, really cared for me, at least, you know, speaking. So I was devastated to hear this, especially for his family.
It's I just felt so awful for that their family. And I mean, this guy was just, he had such an energy about him. I had such a respect for him because he was just such a great leader. I've seen a lot of people that have like no one like. He just had this like contagious like smile. He had these like he has just lived like such a unique life within sports. Like his favorite photo was he ended up on the front of the Toronto Star the day after Joe Carter hit his winning home run in the World Series in 93. Like if you pull up this picture, he's right there with his camera and shooting Joe Carter. And he got the first interview with Joe Carter after he hit this home run that he was just on the field for. And I mean, I guarantee somewhere in my parents' storage, I have this newspaper because I would always save like any historic event. And, he would always like repost it like every now and then. And it's like he's right there on the far left holding the camera up as Joe Carter's being hoisted up.
I'll just also say, like, working in Canadian media, and especially something like a niche Canadian sports media, it's not been easy, you know. And he's somebody who I think like was probably of a generation that was just like before ours, that might have not had sort of the advantages with like sort of like new media that I would say we might have just barely made the cutoff at. And so You see the daily struggle of like, you know, like we were a part of it, you know, like working in a place that just where your opportunities didn't feel like they were necessarily growing. But like, despite that, I would say like Glenn like worked his ass off. And by the time he got to the Fight Network, I don't know, like offered a ton of leadership and experience for people like you and I that didn't really, you know, we were always in need of somebody like that. And just had generally a really great attitude. It was easy to talk to, was fun to hang out with, and part made sort of going to work like, you know, that enjoyable. So,
yeah. I just wanted to share, like, for me personally, and I don't want to make this about myself, but just to kind of like illustrate the impact he had on me, was that when he came on full time at the Fight Network, like I had, through like other hires and stuff, I had pretty much just been removed from doing anything on television at the time. And this is at a period I was just ramping up podcasts with you. Not just because I enjoyed doing them with you, but I had nothing else to do. I was left here in this job and had pretty much just been put to the sidelines of on-air work. He comes in and it just, like, he didn't know me from Adam. And when there was a need for a fill-in, it was like he just went to bat for why is this guy just sitting here? And I guess had seen some of my work and just vouched for me. And I was supposed to just do a fill-in for a week. And I never left like the hosting work for my remaining time there. And that's just because like it was frustrating for me because I felt like I could do more. I had this confidence in myself, but I didn't have anyone pushing for me until him. And I just, it's something I've repeated many times to other people. Like I will always be indebted to him for just going to bat for me when he did not have to. And I had so much more of a career because of him. My career would have been much different without Glenn McDonald. So selfishly, he meant a lot to my career, but he was just a great person. Take all of that stuff away. Like he was just a great person to be around. I got to travel to Russia with him. I mean, he was just, I'm just so glad I have the memories I do of this guy. Cause he was just like everyone today that worked with him, whether it be at TSN or Sportsnet or the Fight Network. Like it was just, this guy was just so popular among people. He was just such a happy individual. And it was just, he spread that. He was just such, so great for the environment you want to foster at these places.
Yeah. He loved the Smiths. I believe he loved golfing. So hopefully he, wherever he is, gets to enjoy a lot of rounds, whatever golfers do. I know nothing about golf. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, we are going to move on to the news items for the day. And we're going to start off with some not so great news stories, starting off with Daniel Rodheimer, which I'm going to imagine some people know that name, but most are not. He's pretty much a footnote when it comes to WWE history, but his background in professional wrestling was that he tried out for Tough Enough in 2004. And that was the season that Daniel Pewter won, that The Miz came out of, and then signed a developmental deal after Tough Enough. And he was in their developmental program in Deep South in OVW. And then at one period, he was earmarked to be joining Edge and Randy Orton on the main roster in rated RKO. But as the story went, like he just did not want to continue in pro wrestling. And he ended up leaving in the summer of 07. And that was pretty much it for his wrestling career. Like it was really like just a blip. And then he resurfaced as a politician, and he was a former congressional candidate. And he had been, he ran as a Republican in 2020 for the third congressional district in Nevada, lost that general election, and then ran in Texas after that, also losing in an election for a seat. So he is now wanted for murder. There is an open murder charge in Las Vegas Justice Court. This coming from Fox 5 in Las Vegas. As of Wednesday afternoon, he was not in custody, and he is a suspect in connection to an October 29th homicide where authorities learned of a, quote, suspicious death that took place. They learned of this on November 22nd. And the victim, 47-year-old Christopher Tapp, suffered injuries as a result of a, quote, purported accident, dying in hospital, and the death was ruled a homicide after blunt force trauma to the head. And he is one of the suspects. So as of now, a warrant out for his arrest. But obviously there is a pro wrestling connection there with Daniel Rodheimer. The next story, BJ Whitmer. So he received his sentencing. He was, this was back in the summer of 2003. And this story comes from up on the Post Wrestling site from Andrew Thompson. He was released from AEW after being arrested on domestic violence charges. And we got reports from PW Insider and reporter BJ Bethel that Whitmer had received 5 years probation and 120 days on house arrest. The victim in the case told Fox 19 that Whitmer physically assaulted her after their breakup. She shared that she entered her home and he was waiting for her at the top of the steps. She told the outlet she was fighting for her life, and he told her he was going to kill her. Whitmer was arrested for strangulation and second-degree burglary, which in the state of Kentucky is described as entering a place or waiting there with the intent to cause harm. Whitmer took an Alford plea. He is maintaining his innocence, but recognizes there's enough evidence that he could face a conviction in a jury trial. The felony can be scratched from his record in 5 years. And PW Insider goes on to note that it was noted that the victim never completed a medical examination after the incident involving Whitmer, and that prosecutors did not have any physical evidence to present at a potential trial. The victim's communication with AEW, which released Whitmer in the wake of his arrest, was also stated, noting that it may be open to interpretation by a jury. It was noted in the sentencing memorandum that the victim received a cash settlement and signed a non-disclosure agreement with AEW, identified as Whitmer's employer at the time of his arrest. It was stated that prosecutors were aware of her contact with AEW, but the extent was unknown. Whitmer's defense provided confirmation of the victim receiving financial assistance and a settlement from AEW, and PW Insider adding that AEW sources at the time of Whitmer's arrest indicated that the promotion had reached out to the victim to provide whatever personal support they could in the wake of Whitmer's arrest. So, I mean, that's kind of painting the picture, I guess, of what they might have been facing had this gone to trial, and that if they felt this was the best outcome that they were going to get. And I mean, it's, I mean, probation and house arrest, but this was a horrific story. When you read the details, there was a photo of, you know, the markings on her throat after. Like, this was a really grisly story of the details that went down here. So, I mean, just a really ugly story.
So there was a non-disclosure agreement signed with AEW, the report says.
So I don't know what the context is of what the non-disclosure agreement would entail, because this is not a case of that. Like, they cut ties with BJ Whitmer immediately. This was not like some case of trying to keep, I can't speak to like what the language would be, but I mean, from this, it was like they were reaching out to the victim to provide whatever personal support. So that would be the monetary aspect of it. I don't know what the non-disclosure aspect would, why that would be in there, for instance.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they're horrifying. The victim's account is absolutely horrifying. I don't know if I'd be comfortable seeing this man anywhere near the professional wrestling industry again, personally, as a fan. And it sounds like he's getting off pretty easy if this is all true.
Yeah, this is a very, very violent crime. And yeah. I mean, it is, you know, essentially house arrest. And, you know, within 5 years, this can be expunged from his record. The next inductee into the WWE Hall of Fame, joining Paul Heyman, is Bull Nakano.
Yeah.
Not Vince McMahon's Hall of Fame, I guess.
You had other Japanese names in the past. Hall of Fame. I mean, this is somebody who wrestled for Vince's WWE.
Yeah, there was the period in 94 that Nakano did wrestle with her. You know, when I was a kid, I was absolutely fascinated by this performer. I had no idea who Bull Nakano was until she showed up on my screen, and I thought, as a child, I was always just mesmerized by Bam Bam Bigelow with the look, and then I saw Bull Nakano, and it was like to another level, and I just immediate like interest in this woman, because of like the hair, the makeup, the style that was pretty different. Like, I'm 10 years old watching this. I was just mesmerized. I thought this was like the coolest wrestling character as like a 10-year-old watching this.
Totally. I'm still mesmerized, you know, anytime I might, you know, watch something of her from the past. And I don't know. I feel like this and Paul Heyman, like, these are two very legitimate names for a Hall of Fame.
These two would be in any wrestling, traditional wrestling Hall of Fame.
Yeah. And we look to see, you know, who some of these other names are, because, you know, to be able to see if we can infer any sort of difference in philosophy as to what a Levesque-led, you know, sort of a Hall of Fame class might be versus a Vince-led class.
Yeah, but just a quick note on Bull Nakano. Like, she started wrestling at the age of 15 in 1983, and this is like right as like the Crush Gals are super hot, and she's teaming with Dump Matsumoto, and would have such big programs and matches with the likes of Aja Kong, Shinobi Kendori, Kyoko Inoue, Devil Masami, and held the major title there in All Japan Women for almost 3 years, from January of 1990 until November 92. And then she would spend time. She went to CMLL, won the championship there, comes to WWF in 94. And then the division was essentially Bull Nakano and Alundra Blaze, like with the odd match in there with like a Luna Vachon. But it was pretty much a two woman division for the entirety of it. And then when Nakano was done, I mean, so was the division pretty much. And Alundra Blaze by the end of the year is, you know, they're dropping the division, even though she's got the title. And I can't remember what happened with that title after the division went under. It was, can't remember. But yeah, she was like, her career, like she did like a very brief stint in WCW, but by the age of 28, like she was done. And then she becomes like a pro golfer. She eventually makes like the LPGA. Like she was a very high end golfer, wow, which is exactly what 10-year-old me thought would be the prognostication of her career. And then she just came back for like the odd match over the last, like she did a match in 2012. She did like a 30-second match for Manami Toyota's retirement in 2017. But, you know, she's, you know, somebody that, you know, in particular, like in the early 90s was among the best wrestlers in the world.
And as far as like inductor, I feel like Medusa would be a shoo-in.
It seems the obvious one would be her. So that would be my thought process. Unless, you know, we'll see with the inductees, if they want to link, like, say, like an Io Sky or someone to induct, you know, take like one of your modern stars. But to me, Medusa would seem like the obvious one to induct her. Fightful Select reported on Tuesday that Sammy Guevara has been suspended. The site writes that Sammy Guevara is now serving a suspension in connection to the February 14th match he had against Jeff Hardy. During the match, Jeff Hardy sustained an injury and concussion protocol was not followed, which resulted in Sammy Guevara hitting his finisher on Hardy, which we're told should not have happened. We haven't been given specifics on how long the suspension is or additional details. Guevara did end up working a no DQ match with Powerhouse Hobbs after the Hardy match. There were some that thought Guevara's lack of selling after the Hobbs match could have contributed to the suspension, but we have not confirmed as much. And for those asking about the referee's role, we haven't heard of any disciplinary action in that regard as of yet. This is a very unique suspension. I can't think of too many that have been, you know, in this kind of line of like a protocol in the heat of a match where an injury happens and not knowing sort of what the communication was between performers and referee. How aware is Sammy Guevara of the state of Jeff Hardy? Obviously he's knowing, like he's hurt. You can see the blood and landing on him, but you know, we're talking about a live to tape match because this was for Rampage, as I recall. I mean, I look at this and I mean, in the one sense, you do want to make this like a very hard line stance that these protocols need to be followed. But there's also, you know, I think you look at this as well as, you know, you would want to know like the exact details of what was going down in the match. Was it like a direct disobeying of orders or is there a more of a gray area of kind of not even knowing that the guy has a concussion in the moment? And the thought that we always talk about just get to the finish or complete the match as you have mapped out.
Hard for me to see them suspending him if he didn't know that he had a concussion. Otherwise, how would he know to engage protocol? This is a very unique case and a very almost bizarre case just to kind of like, you know, grasp at with the little information that we have. But I think we do know that Sammy, of everybody involved in that situation, was the only person to be suspended. Paul Turner, the referee, was on Dynamite tonight. As far as we know, no sort of disciplinary action to the doctors or whatever physician was ringside. So somewhere in that chain of communication, Sammy was the one they deemed to be the person to clearly disobey whatever these rules are. And it's...
Because he goes for the GTH after the Shooting Star Press. Mm-hmm. Was there a question of the moveset? Like it's very hard to look at. Like remember back at, I think it was the Grand Slam event where Moxley gets hurt immediately at the beginning against Rey Fénix. Mm-hmm. And everyone thinks later it's like the Fénix driver. But it was in fact like one of the first spots of the match was Jon Moxley like violating concussion protocol by continuing on with the match. I mean, that is sort of like it just opens up this whole spectrum of, and it's very hard to be able to get into the mind of the performer, is that they are hardwired to complete the match, to continue. And
so for one thing, we don't know what concussion protocol entails in AEW. Secondly,
it would be something very helpful to have a little bit of knowledge of what exactly that is.
That's up to them to volunteer, you know, to communicate to the public if they deem it's worth their while, which I think, you know, transparency in with something like this is always worthwhile to communicate with your audience. The other question is, should the protocol not simply be to end the match, when you realize somebody is concussed. We are seeing currently, you know, with the WWE, they have no issue stopping a match. Finish be damned, you know, like it's over. It's over. This fictitious acting stage play is done because
it's done. Head or neck. If there is concern, that's automatic. And that one you cannot put on the performers. You cannot be entrusting them to be able to wave off a match. There has to be a mechanism in place that they are protected from themselves. And that would be on the referee or whoever is communicating to the referee. I'm with you. I think that if you have a suspicion of a concussion, probably time to just wave off the match at this point.
I think that's the bigger, like, to me, possible fault you can lay at AEW itself, you know, in a story like this. Why even leave it up to the performer at that point when you have the ability to
end? It's the secondary blow that is the, like, could be more damaging than the initial one. And, like, we know enough that just, like, avoiding the head does not mean that you are going to be safe from a concussion. Like, you can just be rattled and that's going to impact you. Like, just taking a back bump could be very dangerous.
Just taking a roll up, is probably frowned upon in that state. So yeah, a lot of questions. I hope to hear a bit more clarity from Tony Khan about.
New Japan held their 52nd anniversary card today. 3,008 people at Ota Ward City Gymnasium. Three New Japan Cup matches. We got a classic. 2 minutes and 56 seconds of Toru Yano beating Yujiro by countout. Yoshihashi over Kenta. And Jungle Jack Perry defeating Shota Umino with a running knee attack and then joining the House of Torture.
Well, I don't know if he's very jungle anymore these days. He's more of a, you know... I don't know, cave, like wherever darkness is, you know, caveman. Yeah, sure. Jungle Jack, Jack Perry is now part of the House of Torture. I mean, House of Torture are probably like the most like dunked on faction, at least in sort of like, I don't know, relevant professional wrestling. And it's almost like putting on one of those shirts is like the worst scarlet letter you could have as a professional wrestler. But I mean, I don't know. I don't completely hate it. I can't really say that there's a ton of buzz about this Jack Perry run so far in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And I think,
I mean, there hasn't been much to it. I mean, this is his first match.
I suppose so. But even that, like, I don't know if there's a ton of buzz about something like this. I saw the match, like, it was okay. Like, nothing sort of that mind blowing up to the standard that I think we get on a weekly basis today. I do like that he's more ingrained in within like a New Japan sort of like, you know, universe. Mm-hmm. And and the choices were, if you're a heel in New Japan, you're either going to be in House of Torture or you're going to be in Bullet Club. And I think we've seen enough like Bullet Club members from America. So whatever.
And then the main event, Tetsuya Naito defeated Sho with the Destino in the main event with your IWGP World Heavyweight Champion and Junior Heavyweight Champions. So I have not seen the show, so I cannot say yay or nay on the card. But the New Japan Cup continues Thursday with TJP against David Finlay, Tangaloa against the Great O'Khan, and Tomohiro Ishii against Chase Owens. And Friday is a much more promising lineup. Shingo Takagi against Yuya Uemura, which might be the best match of the opening round. Gabe Kidd against Callum Newman that I'm looking forward to. And Hiku Leo against Oleg Bolton. I don't think this is going to be a great match, but I'm semi-intrigued by it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if I share your enthusiasm, but yeah,
I just want to see what that match looks like. It's not a match that I imagine is going to be smooth, but I would, who knows? Takagi and Uemura, that should be tremendous on Friday. And there you go. We have also a anniversary report up on the site from Karen Peterson. So she was up early to take in Show's main event and Jack Perry going to the dark side. So a whole report from Karen Peterson up on the site, along with great stories from Andrew Thompson, Jack Wanon, the whole team. Always firing on all cylinders up at postwrestling.com. You can also catch today's Pollock and Thurston, where we went heavily into the Ashley Massaro investigation, the details of which were released last Friday with the NCIS investigation that was completed back in 2020. And Mark Shapiro doing a Morgan Stanley conference today. And boy, making it very clear that they have cut ties with Vince McMahon.
So I found that very interesting. Like just how much he wants to communicate to the world that TKO is no longer involved with Vince McMahon. This person will never return. I want to see how much that will be reflected in the on-air product itself. I know that in 2K24, at least in one of the cutscenes involving Charlotte, they've started to blur out Vince McMahon's face. Now he's still in like a lot of the images, like of I think like the Austin feud, like stuff you just really can't get rid of with Vince.
Like but the story, like the 40 years of WrestleMania, like you would think like his voice is, I have no idea, but I'd assume his like image or voiceover is involved.
He's still all over the game, but like in at least like one particular moment, a cutscene I've seen involving Charlotte, his face is blurred out. So like how much is that going to extend to anything on television? Is his name ever going to be brought up again willingly? I at this point, I can't really say, I can't really think so, especially like, you know, given one of the heads of TKO being this sort of public about, you know, their feelings on Vince's association. And
he's radioactive at this point to TKO. I'm not stating that they won't slow roll Vince back in terms of referencing him. I really don't believe they're going to be doing anything more than that. But the idea of 12 months down the road, 3 years down the road of more, you know, having been, like, you really, if you are marketing your history, he's not a simple edit. He's not someone to just like get around in an easy form. And how much are they going to be held to criticism for that as well? When they're not working with the guy, he's not involved in anything with the company beyond the fact he owns 9% of TKO stock. And who knows what that percentage will continue to drop to if he has more stock to sell. I mean, he has liquidated a whole lot of cash that he has for whatever reason with this recent stock sale on Monday, that he's got pretty much over $1 billion in his piggy bank.
Right.
God knows what with.
Well, I can't see him starting a football league right now.
Probably not. I can't see him attaching his name to just about anything that is asking for public support. Mm-hmm. That would be a pretty tough ask of the audience. All right, all your news up at postwrestling.com. We are coming up on Thursday with Rewind Away, where we are going to chat about something totally out of context on tonight's Dynamite, Okada Omega from June of 2018, the legendary 2 out of 3 falls match from Osaka Joe Hall, as Kazuchika Okada, after 2 years as champion, runs in to Kenny Omega for their climactic match after a series of legendary matches.
I would say very good timing for us to be talking about this particular match, considered perhaps the greatest match of all time, at least according to Dave Meltzer's star ratings, the only 7-star match that has ever been, according to Dave Meltzer's ratings. So is this the greatest match of all time? Let's rewatch it every fall, all 2 out of 3.
Okay, well, we are going to be chatting about that on Thursday, along with the other top matches on the show. So postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you 30 months access into all of the bonus shows we do, including Rewind Aways every other week, Ask Away, Talk, Collision Course, Rewind to SmackDown, and an archive that dates back to December of 2017. 152 editions of Rewind Away to assault your ears with.
Assault? I mean, I wouldn't call it that. It's more of a massage.
Okay.
The opposite of assault.
Massage, whatever you want to do to your earbuds, we have the audio for you. So check it out, postwrestlingcafe.com.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today.
On to Dynamite tonight, the Gas South Arena in Duluth, Georgia. 2,958 tickets out, according to WrestleTix. And this is a big ask of this market because they are running back-to-back nights at this arena. They were doing Dynamite and Rampage tonight and Collision tomorrow. So, I mean, this was not a overwhelming number for night one. And I guess it will be interesting to see. I was mentioning this with Brandon today of, as the year goes on, do we see some of these attempts at doing back-to-back nights in a city that might be a little more costly, but how many of those markets can support one, much less two nights of AEW in an arena? You know, Duluth, Georgia, it's not as though they were, you know, this was the hottest ticket.
I mean, we were talking all about this during their Canadian tour, right? How much of it is just simply cost savings for staying in the same area versus what you might be losing by, you know, not having the biggest attendance for these shows?
Well, it was the season premiere, so that means new theme song, new entrance, and Excalibur welcomes us to the latest season of Dynamite. We didn't even get a last year on Dynamite recap or anything like that.
Did you, what did you think of the new look and logo and set and everything?
Nothing offensive. I thought it was a nice change of just updating everything. I think every so often to do a nice little refresh is nice to do, just changing things up a bit.
This change came certainly a bit sooner than I was expecting, because it was only, I mean, a little over a year ago when they debuted their last look, and I believe it might have at least been in part to maybe... I don't want to say like bad response to it, but maybe some criticism to the old set, which I didn't really have that much issue with. But clearly there was some clamoring for the return of the double tunnels and the return of color that's not just red and blue. And I like it a lot. I mean, I think it looks really grand. It looks very professional. And it, in terms of, like, I think the elements that are available, it feels like it's an upgrade of the original concepts of the original set. You have, of course, the double tunnels, which I assume they'll continue to use more prominently to tell their stories of who exactly is a babyface and who exactly might be a heel. The color scheme
is confusing at times.
It could be, yeah. Some people might have to walk right down the middle. And or maybe change their mind partway through. The color scheme I like a lot. You know, it's like it's orange and blue, which is kind of unique to other wrestling shows that are available. The closest you might be able to say would be like something like 205 Live, but I think it looks very unique unto itself.
The colors are kind of like almost NXT 2.0-ish.
Yeah, that comparison has been made. But I think like taking the green out still gives it like, I would say, like a tone. And I like it overall. Like, it's not like the old set was bad, but I think change is good to signify a new era, which is, I think, what Tony wanted to communicate, certainly with a show like this. And, you know, it's also a makeover that has a bit of meaning attached to your original sort of existence as well.
Well, more important than just, like, updating your look and song, they did some really important story stuff on this show that we can probably look back on as sort of planting seeds for some big things for the months to come. It starts off with Swerve Strickland being interviewed by Shivani, and he notes how he came up short. Maybe he is not meant to be champion. The crowd chants, "You deserve it." And he felt the people rooting for him for the first time on Sunday. He's not going to let those people down. He's coming for Joe, and he's going to beat him for that title. So Joe comes out stating, "It's too bad that your house exists in my world." Swerve wants to face him tonight, and before they can get an answer, the Undisputed Kingdom arrive, and Cole explains that the only story coming out of the pay-per-view worth talking about is us, with Roderick Strong winning the title, with Bennett and Taven as the ROH tag champions, and Wardlow now the number one contender. And the reason that Joe is champion is because we let it happen. No one's going to care about you, Swerve, in 6 months. There's no way you're winning the title, but Wardlow will. And he's going to be challenging very soon without giving a time that he will be using his title shot. Swerve notes all the times that Adam Cole has fallen short and laughs at Adam Cole being a manager. And if you need some new clients, I've got Britt Baker's second phone number in my pocket. And if he needs, Cole suggests that they do a tag match next week. But Shivani announces the tag match is going to happen right now with Joe and Swerve, the two partners. Can they get along against Matt Taven and Mike Bennett to kick off the new era of Dynamite?
Right. Yeah. Can they get along? Yeah. Interesting. Well, first I'll say, you know, this felt very much like an attempt to keep Swerve and Joe alive in the background while, you know, Joe is, doing something with the Undisputed Era. But it seems like Swerve and Joe is maybe the focus for the upcoming pay-per-view, what's it called, Dynasty. Swerve sounded great here. This was like what I would consider to be his first real promo as arguably the company's top featured babyface act. Like, it doesn't feel like there's anybody bigger in that role on the show right now, and I'm including people like Danielson and Moxley. He sounded very comfortable and commanding of this crowd, sounded very genuine and determined to finish his story, so to speak, and even delivered some like fan-friendly comedy here, which was a bit better than Diarrhea Dwayne, I'll say. So I think he's certainly living up to like the role of the spotlight, and he really does feel like the top guy on this particular episode. Conversely, man, Adam Cole, it's been a while, I feel like, since we've seen him, at least in like, you know, maybe like a world title program. It feels, I didn't find his promo very threatening at all. I haven't really found any of his promos as part of the Undisputed Kingdom that threatening whatsoever. The group, of course, hasn't really been booked great, but I think a lot of it was reliant on Cole's mic work to maybe lift them up to a higher level, and I really haven't been that impressed.
It's like, yeah, you have put these belts on them, and I think tonight, though, it's like you have established what everyone is going to perceive as the heel group in AEW, and it's not Undisputed Kingdom that is at the top of that list. So I think they are there's a lot working against them, and like we have been a broken record on the Undisputed Kingdom. Like, it has not reached the level that this buildup was designed to elicit of these performers. So we have the tag match. Taven misses Joe and drop kicks his partner, Bennett. So Joe hits a senton. They go through the break. Swerve gets the tag, and the whole crowd is behind him. He hits a rolling flatliner and then a brainbuster to Bennett. Taven stops him from hitting the Swerve stomp off the top, but he fights off Taven, lands the stomp, house call to Taven, and then the JML driver that is now being called Big Pressure onto Taven, and he wins in 6:52, gets up and just stares at Samoa Joe as they play it up that Swerve did all of the work on his own and didn't need Samoa Joe's help to get the win. And thus, we've got a future ROH tag title match, right? They've got to be going for the tag titles now, I thought.
Are you kidding me? No, I don't think those titles are relevant whatsoever. And if you weren't sure about it, you had one guy beat your ROH tag team champions basically single-handedly in this match. I did not like that aspect of this match at all. I mean, you say what you will about like the tropiness of having two rivals tagging on after an opening talking segment of a show. I mean, that I don't think was great. But like, if they could tell a better story, then I would be open to it. But man, you add on to the fact that it's their ROH tag team champions and they're just basically jobbing, you know, to one guy, a main eventer, that quickly. I hated that aspect of this. But maybe this, you know, the storytelling was fine between Joe and Swerve.
99% of times, I hate when a champion loses in a scenario where you know it's not building to a title match such as this. That 1%. Was going to be in the main event where the ROH champion losing that match got over like X infinity more than he has in pretty much his whole duration here. I think that is going to be the lone exception, as I don't believe Will Ospreay is going for that TV title.
No, not at all. But I mean, the TV title is so lowly ranked, you know, and so, and Will Ospreay is like, you're trying to portray him as like the very, very, very top of like the mountain right now. This is like basically one guy beating two. That's the story that they're trying to communicate.
Again, I didn't have an issue with the main event. This one was more so just, I mean, it was more just an indictment of these tag titles that I don't think anyone was even thinking of that, which only underlines that point. Wardlow walks down the ramp and Swerve is staring at him when Joe applies the Coquina clutch from behind onto Swerve as Wardlow watches on. So that's kind of our title mix at this point. You swap out Hangman and in comes Wardlow to be the other body in the world title dynamic. Mm-hmm. Renee is speaking with Hook when Chris Jericho wanders in and mentions wrestling Taz 28 years ago in ECW and getting dropped on his head. So he's got a connection with Taz, and therefore he has a connection to Hook. And he respects Hook after Hook suplexed him on Sunday and says, "You're the real deal." And he puts out his fist and Hook fist bumps him. He said, "Thanks, Dad."
He said, "Bet," actually. Bet.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, you like, what, bet. I guess that means like, yeah.
Or cool. I use it all the time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Jericho is good at like coming up with these sort of like personal ways of telling stories between himself and various members of the roster, even if it's somebody like Hook that, I guess on the surface you wouldn't expect them to have that much in common with, but he's kind of has attachments to almost everybody through wrestling history that he's able to find something from somebody. And, you know, I think Hook obviously is somebody who doesn't speak much, so he needs somebody like a Jericho to attach himself to in order to tell a deeper story. So we'll see what that is.
They showed footage of Hangman attacking the referees at Revolution, and we cut to the Young Bucks, who have two huge announcements for later in the show. But first, it's Hook and Brian Cage for the FTW title. That means anything goes, and they had a wild, hardcore brawl that incorporated fire extinguishers, kendo sticks, steps. The best line of this match: Brian Cage grabs a microphone cord to use as a weapon, and Taz goes, "Hopefully he isn't going to cut a promo. That won't be good for anybody." Hook suplexes him onto a guardrail in the corner. He's delivering crossfaces, but before he can go for the red rum, it's Cage with a wheelbarrow into a reverse neckbreaker, hits a powerbomb and an F5 onto a chair, but Hook kicks out. So Brian Cage brings in thumbtacks, puts them all over the mat. Hook avoids being dropped on them, and then Hook uses the kendo stick, and an overhead suplex sends Brian Cage onto the tacks, and then he applies the red rum. Cage gets to his feet, and he does like the Mick Foley spot where he just gets dropped backwards. And so Hook falls down on the tacks, but he doesn't let go of red rum, and Brian Cage is out in 10 minutes and 9 seconds. I thought, for if you're going to utilize these tacks, I thought it was a pretty good finish to utilize.
I love the finish here. Yeah. And we're talking about a time where I feel like, I don't know, the thumbtack spot, I mean, still gets a big reaction, but it certainly maybe lost some of the, I don't know, shock value, certainly. And there's no
coming off of a pane of glass on Sunday with merely tacks.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I took thumbtacks this morning. You know, what's the big deal? But like, I think what was novel about this was the way they used it to showcase Hook's will to win and to toughen out like pain. I thought it was very well utilized here, you know. So it was not just a win where he beat a guy, it was a win where he was able to show that he's tough, he's got something special about him that's not necessarily related to his size nor his skill that makes him somebody that you should be cheering for. This was a great hardcore match. They achieved like a really high level of energy right from the get-go. I think Brian Cage is so incredibly consistently good, you know. I don't know if I've ever seen like a bad performance from him. Great offense. The man like almost never screws up with whatever sort of like he, you know, is demanded of him. And I don't know, I feel like at this point, like, he would be categorized as somebody that I feel is certainly better than his push.
Bet. The Gates of Agony run in, attacking Hook. Like, oh my God, it's Khan and Toa. And Chris Jericho runs down to clear the ring with the bat. And I was thinking, like, maybe this is something for, could you see this happening at like Supercard, like a tag match?
What's Ring of Honor about it, though? I guess it doesn't matter. They're Ring of Honor?
Yeah.
Are they champions or something? What's Ring of Honor? What's Ring of Honor about them?
Gates of Agony? They're like attached with ROH.
Oh, okay. Are they officially signed to Ring of Honor or something?
Okay. Your answer is no. It's happening.
Sure. Why not? Like, what the fuck? What is Ring of Honor?
The main event. The main event of Supercard of Honor is a stand.
Yeah. I'm going to say yes.
They note the tournament for the upcoming vacated AEW tag titles. And we got a video of almost all the past champions. And they note there will be more than one bracket and it's going to be starting soon. But we got no brackets, no announcements, no dates. It's coming soon.
Oh, that's a big announcement. That's a huge announcement that they could
more than one bracket.
I'm guessing Dynamite bracket and Collision bracket, perhaps.
I guess they
will. Or a Ring of Honor bracket.
Huh? Who would be in the Ring of Honor bracket?
I don't know.
Best friends and Orange Cassidy are interviewed by Renee, and Renee asks, what is Orange Cassidy going to do now? He says, the same thing I've always done, and he's going to fill his backpack with another title, okay? And they ask if the best friends will enter the tag tournament, and Chuck is like, no, I'm still hurt. So maybe Orange Cassidy and Trent should team up, and they state they will have their first match on Rampage, which Excalibur clarified, that's not a tournament match. That's just a precursor to them joining as a team. I'm sure these two have teamed in the past, but you get to see it on Rampage.
It's an appetizer for this tournament. Yeah, you get to see.
And it does seem to lead you in the direction that you are going to get this Trent turn at some point that they are going slow with, but continuing to tease.
Does it really tease that? I feel like we've been kind of past that, and he's shown his true colors, which are that he is a best friend, a loyal best friend.
Well, I took this to be that this tournament is going to be the breaking point for.
I'll tell you, I hope Orange Cassidy gets something interesting because, like, you compare like how he came off of the last All Out the TNT title run, where he felt like one of the hottest guys in the company. And then after that loss, they didn't really capitalize on it. I mean, obviously, because of the Moxley injury, they had to put the belt on him. But this feud, the second run with the TNT title feels almost just like we've been through this and, you know, the matches are great, but it's not like at the same level of like excitement as we had the first time. Now that he's done both these runs, I hope he's somehow able to elevate himself to like world title contender status, and entering a tag team tournament with Chuck Trent Barretta doesn't exactly tell me that they have those plans for him. And it's very deep waters in AEW right now. So what exactly does that mean for an Orange Cassidy?
Killswitch and Matt Menard coming off of the pay-per-view. This was a very quick match. Menard's ribs are taped up. Christian's on commentary. He notes that there's all these young lions in AEW. I'm going to hold them all down. And Killswitch hits a choke slam, pair of extinctions, and beats him in 2 minutes and 7 seconds. So your analysis on Sunday of, is Matt Menard really of the caliber to be getting involved in this match and stopping Killswitch? Well, the answer was probably not.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why they did what they did on Sunday to try to build to this match, but it looked pretty ridiculous having like Daddy Magic chase Killswitch away. So I don't know, maybe that this was them properly balancing the scales here. How did you watch today's show, by the way?
I watched it on a good old NordVPN.
Did you?
Yeah.
How did you hear about it? Because it wasn't in the earlier part of this show.
Oh my God. You know what? I need to go regroup. Time out.
It is 2024, and tracking technology from advertisers, ISPs, and hackers is getting more sophisticated than many of us can understand. Something you can do to give yourself a bit more peace of mind this year is to protect your browsing by investing in a trusted VPN like NordVPN. Voted best VPN for privacy of 2023 by security.org, Nord is one of the most established and reputable VPN providers in the field. NordVPN is also something I use every day to access geo-blocked online streaming services like AEW+. By far the best way of watching AEW programming commercial-free with on-demand access to AEW's entire TV archive. But perhaps the most value I've gained from using Nord has been the ability to unlock cheaper prices to online content from other parts of the world. And from now until March 20th, when you sign up at nordvpn.com/postwrestling, receive 4 bonus months at discount pricing on all 2-year plans. Plus, users in the U.S., Canada, U.K., and Australia receive an Uber Eats voucher valued from $10 to $30 with their standard, plus, complete, or ultimate plan. Again, that's nordvpn.com/postwrestling. Sign up for as low as $2.91 a month and enjoy some free Uber Eats, along with all the benefits of a premium VPN like Nord's. I know who I'm not sharing my Uber Eats voucher with.
Well, what can I say, guys?
Maybe I just got to like hold up like a little flag or something.
Yeah, you, we apologize to all the loyal NordVPN subscribers out there that were just at the edge of their seat waiting for that one. I was totally going along with you too. I had no idea what you were asking me. Well, now that I killed the switch, on to the post-match here. Daniel Garcia gets involved. Then Nick Wayne runs in. He gets dropped by a boot and Garcia takes a Wayne's World. So keeping Daniel Garcia in the loop here.
Yes, he is. Yeah. Attached to with Adam Copeland, looks like.
And the patriarchy is watching the beatdown, and they make their way up the ramp when out of nowhere comes Adam Copeland with a chair shot, chokes out Nick Wayne, and stops Shayna Wayne from hitting him. By the way, Shayna Wayne has a new shirt that just reads in giant block letters, Mother.
Mother Wayne, specifically.
Does it say Mother Wayne on it?
It says Wayne in smaller font.
Oh, I can only see Mother. I think Mother is even better than Mother Wayne. We get it.
Mother would be pretty cool. Anyway, yeah.
That'll be my birthday present for Davey Portman. And Christian just runs away from Copeland through the crowd, out to the back, gets in. He literally commandeers a car. I think this is a felony that we just saw on TBS, and drove off after assaulting this man. And Copeland is just too late to get him, and then looks into the camera and says, "We're gonna end this where it started, in Toronto, March 20th, in an I Quit match for the TNT title."
Yeah, as we suspected here, you know, when they kind of surprisingly took Adam Copeland versus Christian, or at least took Adam Copeland off of Revolution, you know, suspected that they might have done that. They might be saving it for Toronto. It makes sense. Yeah, sure.
Renee interviews another Canadian, Kyle O'Reilly, who was backstage after nearly 2 years away. He thought he might never wrestle again, but he's got a second chance to provide for his family. He's grateful, and he has nothing but love and respect for the Undisputed Kingdom, but he has fallen so far down the mountain. He doesn't know what path he is on, and he needs to do this on his own this time. And yes, so it looks as though he is going to be on the outs with the Undisputed Kingdom, but I imagine their paths will intersect in some form.
Seems like this was him clarified that he's not going to be a part of the group and that he's going to be on his own. And does that mean that he'll be divorced entirely in story from the Undisputed Kingdom? I guess we wait to see. I don't know if this interview itself was that emotionally impactful to maybe convey exactly what the man had gone through. I think there's certainly a bigger way for them to tell the story. And I think like he's definitely somebody who would probably really benefit from video production to help him. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I guess I wanted to note was we had a caller talk about Kyle O'Reilly's hair and shirt. And at that point, I had kind of dismissed it. I'm like, okay, whatever. The man's seen a lot of shit. This shirt, I do have a lot of agreement with. This shirt, whatever, like if you haven't seen this, it's a white shirt with like, you know, intentional sort of like these like spots. Mm-hmm. That just ends up looks like he's like, you know, poured like a McDonald's Happy Meal all over his shirt. Like these look like the worst grease spots on a t-shirt ever. So maybe there's something to, you know, what that caller mentioned.
He's going for, I think this is a deep story that he is starting at the bottom of this comeback, and we're going to slowly see him rise up in his wardrobe and you know, his hair. This is Kyle at the bottom.
The Undisputed Kingdom will buy him a new shirt.
Yes. Okay, that might be. They'll give him like a per diem, a clothing per diem.
Well, he turned down their shirt, so.
That's right. They literally gave him like 100% cotton. And he went with the oil stains. They recapped Sting's retirement, and this included footage off the pay-per-view in the locker room coming out, and Shivani welcomes the Young Bucks, who kick Tony out of the ring, and they scream that Sting and Darby cheated, and they have ended Sting's career forever.
And the Young Bucks state that they are entering the tournament, so we have at least one team in this tournament. And they go on to announce that Hangman Page, after his actions, is suspended indefinitely from the Elite.
Mm-hmm. Suspended indefinitely, but not completely gone.
No, no. He, too, did not follow concussion protocol, and this is indefinite.
So, again, not suspended from AEW, but the Elite.
From the Elite, yes. And then, Kenny Omega, you've not been making your dates for any good reason, and therefore you are fired from the Elite.
Yeah, this is a permanent firing.
Yes. So, I mean, you had the announcers screaming. It's like, it's a health issue. And then Eddie Kingston comes down and he says, you guys were going to find me if I talk crap about you. So take it. And he whips money at them. And Matt is saying, let's take this offline. And Kingston attacks them. There's a low blow by Matt. And as they set up for the EVP trigger, we see the Rainmaker theme play. And the place goes wild. And entering is Kazuchika Okada. And he comes down and he stands alongside Eddie Kingston like they're going to oppose the Young Bucks, but then grabs Kingston by the belt, flips him around into a Rainmaker, and he is with the Elite. And they just look into the camera. I thought this was so great. This debut, it was so simple, and they set up so much. They have got an immediate program with Eddie Kingston for the short term. You have established to me the heel unit in AEW. And on top of that, they have pretty much told you at the very beginning of this that you are getting Okada and Omega at a date to be determined. They did so much here in like a 5-minute segment. I thought this was a tremendous introduction. And for anyone that is questioning starting off Okada as a heel, please go back and watch some of this guy's heel work. It is the best Okada. I think this is a great introduction for him.
All you have to ask is, how did he start in New Japan as the Rainmaker? You
know, I mean,
this is the Rainmaker character, right? I was not expecting this. I was not expecting his debut. I thought they would have like saved it for big business next week, if anything. To give it to us on this show unannounced, I really liked it. I mean, you're coming off of, I think, some of the fumes of Revolution, and you're at the point now where you can afford to spread the wealth. You know, you got your Will Ospreay debut at Revolution. Let's follow it up if our next show with Okada, and then the next week you're gonna get Sasha. It was wonderful. I also didn't expect them to portray him as a heel. I thought, like, who's going to boo Okada, right? You know, it kind of makes sense to portray him as a babyface. But I really do like the idea of him being a heel here. For one thing, you have the connection with the Bucks with their history together. The money thing, you know, is kind of perfect right now with their EVP role. And the matchups for Okada as a heel, I think, are so much more attractive than what they would be as a babyface. Like you mentioned, Eddie Kingston, the Omega match down the line. The man looks just like a million bucks.
He looked awesome here. Like in a suit. He just had so much charisma just the second he walked out here. I do have to say, like, when they did this shot and you've got the money coming down and this pose, first thing I was thinking is that, man, Mercedes fits in really well to this group if they were to add a female, but I don't know if they go that direction.
But they don't even like do that much storytelling with like female members. Like the most is what? Like a Julia Hart?
Well, that's a problem that could be rectified.
I mean, like in the body of like a men's group, but they could. Yeah. You know, you also have now the Bucks who can theoretically be a mouthpiece for Kazuchika Okada, you know,
this
to be able to
serves a lot of functions. Yeah. I think this is this was a really great introduction and set up a lot right away. And I mean just the stories you can do of, you know, Hangman Page is going to be off for some time now. You've kind of put Kenny and Hangman now as this kind of like they've both been now kind of rejected by the Elite. You have their history. I mean, in a perfect world, they'd be in this tag tournament, but I don't think that is obviously happening for Kenny's reasons. But anyway, down the road, man, I love the fact that they introduce so many different things, short term, but more importantly, long term stuff as well, from just such a basic segment to introduce this guy.
And there's plenty of time in the future to do your babyface Okada run. I think this offers a more proper introduction for Okada to the AEW universe. And people are going to love him through these matches anyway, so they'll be ready for a babyface turn at any point.
So great segment. They followed that with Chris Statlander against Riho that went almost 10 minutes, and they worked through the break, and Riho lands a drop kick. She's fighting back in the corner, and then there was this rough looking lariat by Statlander to Riho's face, and the announcers are just literally said that looked like it sucked as Riho just crumbles to the ground. But she comes back with the tiger faint kick, and Chris deadlifts her into a power bomb. There was Riho hitting a dragon suplex, and the crowd was getting into this with the covers. It's like, Riho, you put her in as like the undersized baby face. Nine times out of 10, it's going to get over, and it got over here. Stokely then places the chain on the mat, and you have this long deliberation by Statlander. Is she going to use it? Is she not? But she decides to put it on the floor, but for all this time, she's letting Riho recover, and they go into some covers back and forth, and then it's Riho countering with a roll-up and catching Statlander in 9:51. So yet again, Hathaway is not helping his clients, and Chris Statlander loses again.
With the tease that, like, there's plenty of incentive for Statlander to eventually accept the help and cheat in turn. Yeah. I thought this was a very good match. I mean, for a mid-card match to get this level of reaction at 9:30, I consider that always to be a major accomplishment. That's not easy to do, especially for somebody like as infrequently featured as Riho. Like, she could just pop in and she'll always get this crowd as, you know, an underdog. And I thought she was used like really well against somebody like a Chris Statlander, who is really kind of like honed in on her specific style of being a powerhouse in this division. She has been a lot of fun to watch, you know, in all her matches since she's returned. So I think also at this point, Stokely and Statlander and Willow have received enough consistent airtime across both shows that I think their story is starting to resonate. So, you know, we'll see what direction it goes next.
Yeah, I haven't been as sold on this story with the three of them, but
we at least understand it and know, like,
it's moving in a direction. Yes, we will see if that direction is a positive. Renee is with Toni Storm and Mariah May, who is just running with the Toni Storm outfit now. And now they've made a T-shirt out of it, so it looks like she is just going to be the cosplaying Toni Storm, which is fine for what they're kind of doing here. Toni says it's award season and she's going to be presenting the Toni Award on Collision, but makes it clear that's Toni with an I to avoid being sued. And this is where they reveal Mariah May's first T-shirt, which Toni gets a cut of, available at shopaew.commercial.
Yes, that's right. I think the look is amazing. You know, she looks so much like her, and it's just like,
it is a before and after, like, on your screen pretty much. Yeah. Like, it's pretty uncanny.
And it's kind of perfect for like the understudy, you know, type of character that she's playing. And I think they just continue to find these really great wrinkles to add to this, like, very impressive act. All pun intended, you know, for this Toni Storm character. Do you think the Toni Award segment will lead directly to Mercedes?
Well, they're doing this on Collision.
Oh, it's on this Saturday. Oh,
she said Collision.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was for Big Business.
Yeah, unless I'm mistaken, I was pretty sure she said Collision for this weekend. Then Shivani brings out Darby Allin and is asked, what is it going to be like for you now without Sting? And he brings up the fact that 5 years ago, he was homeless, not all that far away from here in Atlanta. And this past Sunday, I headlined a pay-per-view. He notes, what's next for me? I'm facing Jay White next week, and then I'm going to climb Mount Everest on March 27th. And there's no guarantee that I'm going to come back alive from this. So I just want to thank every fan for giving me this dream. And if next week is my last match ever, I'm going to go out fighting for my life like I always have. This was like, semi-uncomfortable. Like, I don't know what... Kate from Montreal, ever the researcher, actually threw up like stats of like there's been over like 300 people that have attempted to.
Do you know how many people died just last year?
How many died last year?
18 people died climbing Mount Everest. Now that's like, I mean, out of hundreds, like, but that's still not a very,
this is not a like
statistic.
This is not just like a, okay, there's, you know.
This is one of the most riskiest things I feel like somebody could do, but. We know Darby Allin is wired very differently from the typical human being. And, I don't know if there's any sort of convincing him not to do something like this.
Yeah. I don't know. This is, like the sell for this match next week is like, tune in. You might never see Darby wrestle again.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that was like that's sort of like the tone of this promo, right? I mean, this could also just have been his very genuine like want to acknowledge the risk that he's about to take, and that.
Oh, I believe this is his like genuine thought process of this. It's just like
there's
no
easy way to like kind of sugarcoat like with the risk involved in something like this, right? So
yeah. He says no one can ever replace Sting as his tag partner, so he is vacating his portion of the belt and just leaves it in the ring. Jay White and the Guns come out, and they call him stupid for diving off the ladder through glass. So Jay White did like the super babyface promo after the pre-show match on Sunday, and here he was just full-on heel in this segment. Said that you left Sting alone by executing that stunt, and asks, what is Darby without Sting? You're a lost puppy, and we don't need to have this match next week after what you've been through, physically and emotionally, and offers to let Darby hang out with the Bang Bang Scissor Gang. You can be Darby Scissorhands. He's very lucky that Seth Rollins coined the term he did on Monday, because this would have been the most cringeworthy term this week on a pro wrestling show. Darby asks, what have you done since coming to AEW after headlining the Tokyo Dome besides playing with cardboard cutouts? I don't believe the hype, and asks him to come alone next week for their match in Boston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, as we've seen in AEW, people can kind of switch back and forth, but it was certainly notable that like the Acclaimed weren't out here to join Jay White. You know, I think the perception is that at some point the Guns and Jay White are going to turn on the Acclaimed, and that they're still kind of flirting occasionally with him being a heel here. I think Darby spoke a lot of truths, like maybe not, and not just even about Mount Everest, but about like Jay White's status so far. I mean, the Bang Bang Gang are very entertaining, but it's certainly not at the level of Jay White that I think maybe we all expected when he came in here. And also, I really haven't been that impressed with his promos. Like, he sounds fine, but they're very reliant on sort of like, I don't know, delivery rather than substance. And I thought Darby sounded better than Jay White here.
I didn't enjoy Jay's portion of this segment. It just felt he went from like such a serious message and like real emotion that people had coming off this retirement, and even like the content of what Darby's talking about, to just like your cartoonish pro wrestling villain that Jay White felt like here. It just felt it didn't fit the tone that had been set by Darby. Julia Hart and Sky Blue had a vignette where they state that Willow has forgotten who Julia Hart is. I'm the princess of the black room and the keeper of secrets. That's a mouthful. And she is holding an open house on Rampage for a reminder of who the champion is.
Yes.
Wasn't this called House Rules? Or is
That's not open house. House Rules are like, was that open house? I thought House Rules was just like the, you get to choose the stipulation.
Because I thought after this promo that she is selling her residency and we're all invited to take a look and make the best offer.
Oh, really? Yeah. I don't know. Mortgage rates are kind of high right now. I don't know if
the black room is up for sale, and we've got an open house on Saturday. Anyway, so we go to break and we come back, and Julia Hart is now in another vignette with the House of Black, and they run down Mark Briscoe. Brody mentions his wars with the Briscoe brothers. They are the merciful House of Black. They will inflict pain on Mark Briscoe. And it ends with Julia Hart singing Ring of Fire. It's like, what in God's name is going on here?
It sounds like a tease of a flaming tables or flaming something, right? They're calling this an Atlanta street fight, but yes. There's a lot of promise of burning Mark Briscoe. So I think you're getting fire on in this.
And match. You teased it with the pyro last week as well, trying to light them on fire. So Mark Briscoe reacts. He's not scared. He walks through fire and dances with the devil. Let's do it Saturday night with an Atlanta street fight, and I'll do it on my own. He'll take on all three of them. But Jay Lethal walks in, says it's time for me to man up. I love you, Mark. I've got your back. And Mark just warns him, don't bring Jeff Jarrett. But Jay says, we need him. So Mark is like, okay. Didn't take a whole lot of arm twisting for Jay Lethal to convince him. Like, the one person I don't want you to team with. Well,
we're going to. Is Jeff going to take the flaming table?
That would be something if maybe a flaming guitar.
Huh? Okay. Possible. That'd be pretty cool.
So let's go through the lineups for both nights. So Rampage has Action Andretti against Penta, Orange Cassidy and Trent Beretta against The Butcher and Kip Sabian, Private Party versus Top Flight versus Commander and Brian Keith, and Julia Hart against Robin Renegade for the TBS title. Then Collision, which is being taped Thursday, Chris Jericho against Teton, Mariah May is in action, The Elite will debut. So you're getting Okada wrestling a taped Collision from Atlanta on Saturday night. That will be his official in-ring debut.
Do we know the opponent? We don't know the opponent.
They just said in action, so look out for the finest local talent. And then the Atlanta Street Fight, as well as Brian Danielson against Shane Taylor, which is a very interesting match for Collision.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have that. And then
they didn't Excalibur do the rundown this week.
No, they just showed them. They showed the matches during the main event. They just had the graphic come up.
Give the man a break for 1 week, please.
Will Ospreay and Kyle Fletcher is the main event with Don Callis on commentary. They had an incredible match where Kyle Fletcher must mean a whole lot to Will Ospreay, because Will was just like, I am going to give you everything possible in this match to cement your status in this company. And they got nearly 20 minutes to do so here. Some of the highlights included Kyle Fletcher hitting a brainbuster. So they played off the neck damage that Konosuke Takeshita delivered to Ospreay. And then they're holding onto their wrist, chopping one another. Fletcher lifts him up and it's countered with a Ospreay DDT and then a snake eyes to Ospreay onto the second buckle. Ospreay hits an Os cutter on the edge of the apron. There's a tiger driver, reversal of tombstones, ending with a poison Rana by Ospreay. And when he climbs up to the turnbuckle for the leap of faith, he is knocked off balance. And Fletcher goes for a dragon suplex off the top, which Ospreay flips over, landing on his feet, connects with a Liger bomb. And then Fletcher gets this big last ride power bomb. Ospreay kicks out. There's a poison Rana off the turnbuckle that spikes Kyle on his head, and then a hidden blade for a near fall. Kyle gets to his feet. He's striking with Will, and then another Os cutter. Kyle kicks out. Place goes wild, and it ends with Kyle on his knees, knowing that he is defeated, and tells him to just bring it, and he is nailed with the hidden blade. 19 minutes and 23 seconds as Will gets the victory, and the two embrace and shake hands afterwards. Before we get to the final scene, your thoughts on Ospreay's in-ring Dynamite debut since signing?
I thought this match was, amazing. It feels like an understatement. I think there are people talking about Takeshita versus Ospreay being a potential match of the year candidate. I like this match more than Ospreay versus Takeshita. I'm amazed that you can we're possibly getting this quality on free television now. As good as like Dynamite has consistently been and delivered that sort of quality, I think Will Ospreay matches are at a different level, even above that, and that's now what we can continue to potentially.
This is the match Tony Khan was leery about committing to after the guy messed up his hip on that the brainbuster spot on Sunday.
And like, you couldn't really see the welt. I mean, I'm sure it doesn't feel that great. Maybe there, you know, he is Wolverine perhaps, but he's possibly not feeling all that well and still having a match of this quality. This was the type of match where you know these two are probably have a very, very, they do have a very close relationship. You can almost maybe assume almost as like mentor and protege, or even big brother, little brother. And when you have two friends that are that close and that are that giving and that trusting of each other, you get quality like this. It felt like they were almost like kind of mirror images at one point facing each other. And there's good storytelling in there as well, where like they were trying to convey that Fletcher did not, even though Ospreay was selling his back, he did not target the back out of respect. And, you know, at the end, he almost kind of like willingly accepted the loss. But this is like a rivalry that they're building up. And this is almost just, at least in AEW day one, you know, so years down the road, you might, it's similar to Okada and Ospreay themselves.
Yeah. If we are ever fighting and I've got a bad back, don't do me a favor and say, you know what, I'll take it easy on you and I'll just attack your neck instead. You can go for the back if you have to pick between the two. I thought this was incredible. I also thought for those that would look at this as, you know, putting Will out there. I thought this was this was the time to do a big, big match like this on your first TV show and to establish Ospreay as this guy is the best wrestler in the world. And this is the kind of match you're going to get when Will Ospreay is put into a big match to show you, because more people are going to end up seeing this match than saw the Takeshita match on Sunday. This was the time to let him go out there and do this kind of killer match. You don't want to overdo these or make it become just common practice when you see Will doing these constantly. But the timing was right to do this now immediately and set the tone of what a big Will Ospreay match can feel like. And this is Kyle Fletcher. And just think of this roster and the endless options. The first one that we're going to direct you to, of Bryan Danielson, who walks out at the end of the night to just stand in the ring with Will Ospreay, and it goes off the air. And it's like this cliffhanger ending of pointing you in the direction of where they're going. And I mean, you look at this graphic, I mean, you certainly are led to believe of like, there is dynasty right in your face. And
Bernie Danielson's birthday is not that far away, so Brian's going to cram them in. We should be very grateful that they're at least having this overlap in their careers. Now, I mean, yeah, I know Danielson will probably come back eventually to do big matches, but man, now is the time to do something like this. What a pay-per-view level match that is.
You're 6 weeks away. I think that could be, it's a giant match to do.
Huge.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, if this was an intent from Tony Khan to make a statement about this show being a new era and a season premiere, whatever you want to call it, they more than nailed that. You know, first of all, with the set, but secondly, with the debut of Kazuchika Okada, the formation of a new elite, and then Will Ospreay ushering in an even higher status of in-ring quality than we're used to on AEW television. This was a great, great, great addition of Dynamite.
It's not an apples to apples comparison, but the philosophy is kind of the same, but different executions of it. With New Japan, they were losing two of their biggest stars, but their franchise player in Okada. And you watch those New Beginning cards, and one of the things I was harping on was, okay, people are tuning in, and this is the departure of this big star. You want to do some things that excite your base, that yes, we are losing this person, but look at all this other stuff that is now happening, some exciting new things. And
Jack Perry and House of Torture.
Well, there you go. And here's Okada just beating guys left and right on the way out, nothing to maximize that interest with. In this one, Sting is not the be-all, end-all of this company. But on Sunday, it was this huge moment. Everyone was into it. And tonight, if not handled with certain importance, it could have felt like, oh, what a comedown from Sunday and this big emotional high. And now Sting's gone and we're looking backwards. Instead, they used 2 hours to tell you, yes, there's this huge outgoing star, but look at all of the stuff that we have going on here. Tonight was all about buckle up for all these different directions that we have going on, from Okada to Ospreay and Danielson, like up and down.
And Swerve.
Everything was about looking forward and making you excited about this next chapter and branding it as such as the next era of AEW. I thought they did as strong a follow-up to like one of the best shows in company history on Sunday, and following it up with a show that immediately sparks a lot of intrigue in the company of where they're going and building that excitement.
And building interest for big business simply because of the quality of this show. You know, this could have been an off week for them if they wanted, right? You know, you're in between one pay-per-view that people are considering one of your best ever and one of the bigger Dynamites that you've ever built up. This, they could have taken it easier, but they didn't. They gave us a huge, huge, huge edition of Dynamite. So I'm very excited for big business next week. A lot of momentum positively for AEW right now.
Yeah. Like you can find Dynamite episodes that you might like more, like top to bottom and match quality. But in terms of like important shows that felt important and that we can look back on and maybe place more importance on, like I thought this was a very, very strong show in that regard. So, let's go to some feedback and super chats and see what everyone had to say about the season premiere.
Hey, let's go to forum.postwrestling.com. Who starts us off?
Andrew from Cape Breton writes, the talent roster in AEW is pretty ridiculous at this point. I like the direction they're going with Okada by having him heal. Money clips for everyone. And of course, the match with Ospreay and Kyle Fletcher was incredible, which could lead to another incredible match with Bryan Danielson. Speaking of Kyle, at least we now know the level of the ROH titles. Ospreay didn't even want to go for the TV title, and the tag champs got crushed by two guys who hate each other. I'm not sure what the point of ROH is anymore. I can see a lot of AEW's properties getting big upgrades in the next TV deal, but what do you think the future of ROH should be? Should it stay in its current form, become developmental, or be shuttered entirely? I mean, we talked about like the booking. I don't see how you can look at this show and think it was any kind of negative for Kyle Fletcher. I thought he just had one of the matches of his life and one that was widely watched. I don't think he was harmed at all.
So I'll say, I don't know if like the ROH TV title is really harmed, because I don't think about the ROH TV title at all. I totally forgot that even after recapping this match that he's the TV champion. That's how little of importance it registers to me. I believe that like, I don't think the title should be booked like this. I don't think it should be on Kyle Fletcher. I think we've seen a playbook that works by having a sub brand with what they've done in NXT. I think you should have dedicated talents be exclusive to Ring of Honor, and those are the talents that should be fighting for these championships. Those are the talents that are going to make winning a TV title feel like an actual accomplishment, you know. And they can occasionally pop up on the main roster, quote unquote. But like, I think having the Kingdom hold them just to hold belts so that they could job to like one main eventer is it doesn't really do anything for anybody. I think you can do a better job of like, you know, putting value on the belts and concentrating your talent, your roster, so that we can actually identify what an ROH roster is.
Yeah. In turn, I do not see Tony shuttering Ring of Honor. I think he will keep it in this current form if he does not gain a television deal for it. I would say just at the very least, I would look at, like, again, I don't see a whole lot of benefit beyond getting, you know, talent, the ability to have matches. But I think it's a really difficult system when
who needs more matches now? Well, I mean, does the audience need more matches? It's great that talent are getting paydays.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, an audience that, I mean, these are long tapings when you're tacking on another like 90 minutes of ROH matches to some of these tapings. And I don't know if that's kind of the atmosphere you want for these matches. I think quite personally, I think that you get a lot more out of presenting people, give people a kick-ass 48 to 60 minute ROH show per week instead of, you know, 2 hours, yeah, some weeks. You know, unless you're happy with being in this slot where I think ROH is viable enough as doing 3 pay-per-views a year. I think you're going to get your audience for these super shows. And the TV is going to be what the TV is. It's going to be a very small audience that is following this. And if you're happy with that, fine. But it is...
Okay, but what's the point of ROH other than just to maybe make some subscription dollars and some pay-per-view dollars? Like, do you want to... Does Tony Khan want to use ROH as a vehicle to actually make new stars? Or is it just to give people reps that aren't... people, nobody's watching?
I think it's... I think he's looking at it as his closest thing to developmental, that he won't call that, and where you can send people for retooling, and that, like, let's be honest, an Athena is not getting this kind of run in AEW, or at least this kind of television time that you would be in Ring of Honor. Now you can, there certainly is a
Ring of Honor is not really TV time, but I know what you mean. Yeah,
well,
it's internet time.
Listen, I'm not trying to be the defender here for ROH, because I find it to be something that has not worked out in any way, shape, or form like it could. Quite frankly, I feel you could do ROH pay-per-views. I think you could do it without the TV. Like, I think you could I think you could do probably like do quarterly ROH pay-per-views where you build them up. It's some of the rising independent talent that comes in for dream matches. It's a mixture of your AEW stars, and it's branded as Ring of Honor, but it is just this cavalcade of interesting stuff that for 4 times a year you're interested in.
When you say, you know, Ring of Honor is like Tony's idea of developmental, like, what is developmental beyond giving people reps right now? Because like for NXT is also developmental, but they're actually building hype and they're building characters and they're building excitement around new stars so that by the time they debut on the main roster, people already anticipate them and know who a Tiffany Stratton is. When was the last time you got that from somebody coming out of Ring of Honor? Athena would be the only person, I'd argue.
Yeah, I mean, and part of that is they don't present it as developmental, as though it's like a call up. I mean, they are not branding them as like, this is our feeder league where you graduate to the AEW roster. That's not how it's presented either.
It's not really presented as anything but like a bunch of matches.
Yeah. And I mean, the vast majority just view it as it's AEW Dark under a historical name.
Yeah. You know, like maybe a lot of it depends on the TV deals. And then, I mean, you know, let's maybe give him some sort of, I don't know, cut him some slack because he's had to build an identity for Collision over the past year. Now that I think he's done a decent job of that, maybe it's time to look at what a Rampage entails. And then maybe Ring of Honor is after that. Hey, we got a super chat here from Kevin Anderson, who simply says, bet.
It's a big term now.
It's a good word. Nice. Let's go to Muggin, who says, it felt like a new chapter tonight. Swerve is now a babyface on the chase. Wardlow is next up. Cole thinks the world title will be bestowed to him. Not going to happen. Copeland's going to commit patricide on Cage in 2 weeks in their hometown, 30 years to the day of Brett versus Owen. Big ups to John P. for that fun fact.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go to Michael, who writes, what a main event. I'm so glad Ospreay was good to go to give Kyle Fletcher the match of his life on national television. Ospreay has shone a light on members of a faction that before Revolution felt stagnant to me. Now Takeshita and Fletcher are back on the tips of everybody's tongue, as they should be. Danielson coming out during the closing seconds with that grin was great. Something tells me he's not going anywhere. The level of competition is just too tempting to not test his mettle with. And Darby Allin's promo has me convinced he's legit, taking next week as a very possible last match. I think anybody that would be legitimately going to climb Mount Everest would be of that thought process of that you would not, that there's the chance that you would not come back from that. I think that would be just about anyone's idea of doing such a feat. To the Danielson one, I'm really curious of like how big they will play this up as, because he himself has like backpedaled it to like, this is not a hard retirement. This is, I'm going to reduce my schedule. This is not going to be Danielson doing Collision every week, but the idea of him doing select matches, he is very much leaning like that will be the process. So do you build this up as a big, like, I'm counting down to my final full-time career as I segue into part-time? I mean, you could, or you could do something a little more subdued.
Oh, I think there's like, you know, obviously like a lot of marketability around promoting like sort of a semi-retirement, right? And we don't know exactly what he intends on, how active he intends on being. Could it be like, I don't know, as little as like 4 or 5 matches a year? We don't really know at this point. But I do think like they've made a big enough deal of this that I think they will promote something that feels like a semi-retirement match. Let's go to Jordan from the Bronx, who says, a new era of AEW is brewing. Heel Bucks firing Kenny Omega and hiring his biggest rival in Okada is fantastic. A heel Okada and babyface Ospreay on American television feels like a true bizarro world. Add to that Mercedes debut next week. Swerve is a total babyface continuing his world title quest and an eventual Ospreay versus Danielson match in the near future. AEW feels refreshed. Tonight's episode was a great step towards continuing a solid 2024.
Yeah. I mean, this is like Jerry Lawler breaking his leg and Jimmy Hart just like, you know, you take the horse out and get rid of it once they're no longer valuable. Like that's the Bucks here. Like Kenny Omega, he's no longer valuable to us when he's not physically active. So we went out and we got the best guy.
I almost felt like, I feel like that would have been an even stronger promo than just like them kind of, you know, no selling him not being healthy or whatever.
Yeah. Right. We go to Pete in Texas. If Swerve wins the AEW title in April as a babyface, is it too early to both turn him heel and lose the belt in August to Will Ospreay? I mean, someone is going to be the first transitional champion, right?
Transnational champion.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said transitional, but I mean, you kind of would be a transitional champion if you're going from April to August, but transnational champion. I mean, that's,
April to August is a long time, I think. Like, yeah. That's enough for a run. for Swerve. Mm-hmm. And who's to say, like, does Ospreay have to win in Wembley?
I don't think you want to beat him.
Do you even do Swerve versus Ospreay at Wembley?
I would.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows who's going to catch fire by that point? But, I mean, certainly you would expect Will Ospreay to be in that spot.
Or you could do the long chase of Swerve. Like, he doesn't need to win the title next month. It's like, it can be like this long chase for him. Like, he is the long game to get to the title. Like, you can do these longer chases towards the title, like the belt that always eludes this guy that mm-hmm. I mean, we have learned from Cody, like this long run has been the big, like, this has been like great for just the intrigue of this continual climb towards the top to get this title. And if done right, people will have the patience for it.
Yeah. But if done right is the biggest question, right? Like, you are going to take a risk if you don't crown him after a certain point and people get distracted by Will Ospreay and they'd rather see him instead of a Swerve, right? It's very hard to time, but yeah, we'll see what they do. Let's go to Brian from New Jersey. Really hot dynamite to follow up the pay-per-view, an episode where they crammed a lot in, but a lot of it had substance. Really good main event, the best women's match of the week so far in Stat versus Riho, and some great table setting for matches next week. I think Okada's arrival could have been presented as a bigger deal rather than a surprise, but I thought it was well done and gives Mercedes Moné the spotlight to herself in Boston next week. Swerve referred to Adam Cole as Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget, so who would be the Inspector Gadget in AEW?
Prince Nana? I don't know.
I guess wouldn't it be Swerve?
MJF?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. It's late.
Don't know.
I never watched Inspector Gadget for a second.
No, great theme song.
Didn't come across my radar. But on that note, thank you everyone for the feedback tonight and for checking in. A strong turnout tonight for Rewind to Dynamite and a pretty well-received show as well. Seemed a lot of people were into the show, and with big business coming up next week, probably a lot of interest for next week's show in Boston. And in 2 weeks' time, Wei and I are going to be going to the Dynamite in Toronto. So that week, we will be doing a show the next day on the Thursday at noon Eastern time. So we will remind you before then, but you will get our live thoughts on Dynamite in Toronto, tentative on Rampage. We will see.
Yes. Mm.
Depending.
I'm looking forward to it.
As am I. Yes. So that's going to wrap things up. Again, thanks to everyone for joining us. We're back on Thursday with Rewind Away, covering New Japan's Dominion card from 2018, headlined by the 2 out of 3 falls, no time limit bout between Kenny Omega and Kazuchika Okada. As well on that card, Tetsuya Naito against Chris Jericho and Will Ospreay against Hiromu Takahashi in the top 3 matches. So we'll be discussing the top matches on the card. It's a lengthy show, and the lion's share will be dedicated to the main event.
A very good show, though. If you haven't had enough wrestling, watch this.
And a lot of news going on that week in June of 2018. So we will revisit that. All right, that's it for us. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. Thank you to the ever-patient NordVPN. I just noticed I have 2 unseen text messages that came my way. That's my fault for having my phone off. And that is it for Rewind to Dynamite.